Great to have you here again. Hi and welcome. I'm Henrik Palmgren from Götaland in the Kingdom of Sweden. And this is an independent radio program dedicated to questioning the artificial constructs, i.e. the lies around us and the propaganda and the social engineering. We also cover a lot of topics on prehistory and the future, myths and metaphysics, health and conspiracy. RedIceCreations.com has more, and RedIceMembers.com has all we've done from our start in 2006. Mark Weber is an American historian, author, lecturer, and current affairs analyst with a specialized knowledge of U.S. foreign policy, international relations, the Second World War, and more broadly of 20th century European and American history. Weber is also the director of the Institute for Historical Review, IHR, an independent public interest research and publishing center in Southern California that works to promote peace, understanding, and justice through greater public awareness of the past. In particular, the IHR strives to increase understanding of the causes, nature, and consequences of war and conflict. Mark is back today to discuss the current state of freedom of speech and expression, the right to investigate and ask questions about our history and current events. We'll talk about the hate groups that does character assassinations and persecute people for their beliefs and line of questioning. We'll tackle some issues related to demonization of the enemy, whomever that happens to be currently or in the past. We also talk about Ukraine and Russia, also Israel's and the United States' foreign policy and the current climate in the European Union. Welcome back, Mark. It was a while ago since we last spoke. It's great to have you back and talk with you again, so thanks for coming on, Mark.
Thank you for having me back on again. It was a pleasure before, and I'm looking forward to this time.
You bet. We have a lot of things on our plate today that we want to discuss and touch base with, not only a lot of things that goes on today in the world, but also, of course, talk a little history later. But I think we should begin to talk on a note on, well, it really is concerned with free speech, really, and the larger question that ties into it. I happened to see on your website a couple of weeks ago now that finally then you guys managed to restore your credit card processing through the website for your shop after a Zionist campaign to try to shut down this very process. Tell us what happened here, and I think that this is a really important point to go over, Mark.
Yes, it is. I think it's very instructive, and in fact, the fact that there's been so little media coverage of it, I think, is itself also revealing. But last summer, a member of the New York State Legislature named Dov Hickend, who is noted as a very, very pro-Zionist, pro-Israel, very emphatic a member of this New York State Legislature, launched a public campaign. And I say public because he put it on his own website. It was announced in local media in New York that he was going to shut down the credit card processing for the Institute for Historical Review, which I'm the director of, and of some other organizations. He claimed we are so-called hate groups, and he launched this public campaign. Now, it's a little unclear who all he got on board, but publicly he boasted about the fact that he got the MasterCard company to support him in this campaign. And he put on his website a photograph of himself with two officials of the MasterCard company, which, of course, as you know, is one of the two or three largest credit card companies in the world. And the IHR was put on something called the Match List or TMF List, which is normally a list of companies or corporations or agencies that have cheated people in some way, too many chargebacks. Normally, nobody is ever put on this list for any kind of political reason or because somebody doesn't like what they're doing, but that's what happened in this case. One of the unfortunate aspects of the way that the credit card business works is that even though it's become a kind of almost a utility, like the electric power company or something, or the telephone service in our society, it doesn't have any level of oversight. But anyway, because of Dov Hickend's campaign, we were put on this list, and the merchant service provider, that is the company that actually interfaces with us to handle credit card processing, cut us off, even though we've been handling credit cards without any complaint, with no problems for at least 20, maybe 30 years, suddenly we were cut off. Now, for 3 months, then, we were not able to process credit card orders and donations, which in the modern world is a really serious blow to any company or any organization, and it was for us as well. Now, we were finally able to restore it by going to a merchant service provider, as it's called, and persuading them or showing them that they were not going to lose any money that handling our business, and that this was a purely political matter. And we were able also, we had to provide additional guarantees of any problems in case of default or so forth. But the remarkable thing in all of this is that the man who carried out this campaign, Doug Hickend, is himself has a record as a activist of something called the Jewish Defense League, an organization that the FBI and other U.S. government agencies publicly identified as a terrorist group, as a violent organization, a group which had carried out killings of people, bombings, disruption, and violence in the past. And Doug Hickend has boasted and spoken very proudly of his record in this regard, and yet the IHR, which is recognized by the IRS, by the U.S. government, as a public interest educational enterprise that does not advocate violence, we don't advocate discrimination of any kind, we are called by Doug Hickend and people like that a so-called hate group, whereas Doug Hickend, who himself has a record openly in the past and in the present of prejudicial, violent activity and support for violence, he's given this kind of pass in our society, and it's our organization that is demeaned and defamed in this very unfair way.
How does he have this power to do this? I mean, is it a friends thing, a nepotism thing, or how does he manage to influence these major processing services to do this against you guys?
Well, this is revealing because it's part and parcel of how the American political system works. Politicians are able to persuade corporations to act in their interest because they have political clout, and then by the same token, powerful Zionist organizations are able to get politicians to act on their behalf who might otherwise be indifferent because they have money and publicity on their side. This is how the American system works. It's basically a corrupt system. But it's involving the manipulation both of public opinion, but also of money, of campaign contributions and so forth. Now, it may very well be that the MasterCard Corporation simply calculated, well, we'll do this for Doug Hickend. It looks good for his constituents in Brooklyn, New York. This makes us look good. And who cares what the IHR thinks? They're a small organization, and they're not going to make any stink about this. But there are so many examples of this kind of manipulation of the system in the United States to further, in a one-sided way, the interests of and the agenda of groups like Doug Hickend or the Jewish Defense League or the Anti-Defamation League and so forth, which is reflected in a larger way in the very one-sided U.S. support for Israel that's more emphatic and more stronger than that of any other country in the world. And this is a reflection, again, not of of a government or carrying out what's good for America and the world and for humanity, but rather a reflection of who has power domestically, both in the media, public relations, and in money here in the United States of America.
Yeah, well, I mean, let's talk about this for a little bit, these so-called, law groups, hate speech groups who basically, persecute people for their beliefs, for their ideology, for their, they basically lobby against freedom of expression and freedom of speech. I mean, there's a number of these. You mentioned the JDL, but there's the ADL, Anti-Defamation League, the SPLC, the Southern Poverty Law Center. I mean, and they will call anybody who questions anything that goes against the politically correct set, Marcuse policy from the Frankfurt School of repressive tolerance. Anyone who goes against that, they'll deem a racist or a bigot or whatever they need to do. And they have, they build up these websites, of course. They're that get listed high on all the search engines, on people who are basically have questioned things in the manner that you guys have. There's got to be a way of kind of combating that a little bit and starting profile on these guys who are equally repressive and persecute people in the way they do for their beliefs, right?
Right. There should be, and to some extent, the internet has been very important in offsetting some of the almost monopolistic control that existed up until the advent of the internet. So much more information is available, and people can find this out. But it doesn't translate right now into real policy. It hasn't really changed anything in a dramatic way, but it underscores the kind of tension, the chasm between what many people really know to be the truth on the one hand, and what the sort of public policy and the public persona is on the other hand. There's many examples of it, but the most obvious one, I think, is the crass contrast between America's claims to be upholding democracy and freedom and so forth on the one hand, and the U.S. support for Israel, whose policies are in pretty obvious and blatant and ever more obvious contradiction or of international law and the very standards the United States claims to uphold. But the Dovhickan problem over credit card processing and so forth is just typical. I mean, if the same standards were applied to Dovhickan or the Anti-Defamation League that they claim to make against us, there would be a drumbeat of constant criticism of people like Dovhickan and the Anti-Defamation League and the ADL and the SPLC and AIPAC and so forth, but there isn't in our media and in our society. And the real failure, I think, the biggest failure, is by those people who know better but just simply either go along with those in power, do not speak out, and do what the easy thing is. And that's really a part of a much, much deeper kind of malaise and problem, I think, in America and in Western society generally.
Yeah, indeed. And Dovhickan, he was in hot water himself recently, I think. He was in this little scandal there at one of his Jewish holiday parties at Purim, I think it was, when he painted himself, was it black in the face and going as an American, African-American base was it basketball player or what was going on?
Well, he was a little unclear, but he was in blackface, and of course, African Americans find that very offensive. Again, this is part of the how hyped up the whole discourse in America has become. But that level of sensitivity, which is applied when blacks are portrayed in this way, or so Jews, this same standard is not across the board, and of course we're not given the same pass that many others. But yeah,
no.
he was in trouble for this demeaning portrayal of blacks, and this is the really big thing is, you know, unlike the IHR, which is an educational enterprise, Dovhickan or groups like the ADL don't merely express an opinion. They urge support for policy by the United States and by Israel that results in oppression and killing and war.
Yep.
That's a big, big difference. We don't have that kind of power. We don't advocate policy except a general policy of a more enlightened or peaceful policy in world affairs. But groups like the ADL or Dovhickan have the actual power and use their power to support policies which have really terrible consequences. And yet they're not held to any kind of standard of accountability, which is especially important in their case because, as I say, they wield real power, not just expressing opinions.
Yep, I agree. So, I mean, something's awfully skewed and wrong in this picture, and it's increasingly in this kind of matter in the Western world now. They terrorize people. They, you know, hang them out in the media for their historical inquisitiveness, for their beliefs, for having, you know, basically the right to ask the questions about our history. What are they so afraid of, do you think, Mark?
Right. Well, I think what's clear is they want no questioning of a kind of moralistic Manichaean narrative of the good guys and the bad guys. And Israel is especially portrayed in this way. You know, this grip on the media was, amazingly enough, explicitly laid out recently by the Vice President of the United States, Joe Biden. in a talk he gave to a Jewish group last year, he said explicitly that no single group has had anything like the power, the grip on our cultural life, on our public discourse, as the Jewish community has had in America. He says it's greater power than any other single group in America. And that has enormous consequences for not only the United States, of course, but as such a important country in the world, for the entire world, for humanity. And with power should go responsibility and accountability. But in this case, there is no level of accountability or responsibility on this very small minority group, which wields hugely disproportionate power. So skewed, so distorted is the whole situation in America that even to acknowledge that power is considered a sin, considered very bad, except when it's done by Joe Biden, when he's praising people for that power. The disproportionate use of power in our society by any other group would be identified and criticized and so forth, but it's not in this case.
Exactly. So is this the future of freedom of speech, the shutdown of the means that keeps this inquisitiveness going? And I mean, there's many tentacles to this of how this could branch out, and the way then that it might not be an overt kind of way that they do things, but they try to do it kind of behind the scenes and shut it down, the mechanisms behind everything. Is it? I mean, that's not a pretty picture, you know?
Well, it's not a pretty good, it's not a pretty picture, but I think what is happening and what happens in any society where there's a greater and greater chasm between the propaganda on the one hand and what people perceive in their own lives on the other, it leads to a discrediting of the entire system. That's what happened in the Soviet Union the last 10, 20 years before it finally collapsed. That is, even though the media was very firmly in the control of the Communist Party or those in power in Russia, the gap between what they were told, what people were told, and what they could observe was so great that people began just increasingly distrustful and cynical about everything the system said. And that's what's happening in America and in Western Europe. There's an unprecedented level of cynicism and distrust in America by the vast public of all the major institutions, the media, the Congress, the presidency. And this is a very, very dangerous thing for any society when there's this level of not just distrust, but even cynicism of kind of contempt. And it's never been at this level in American history. But we're seeing this not only in the United States, but also in Europe and in much of the, you might say, Western world. This is a very, very dangerous thing. That's so that even though the suppression of free speech, to me, that's a symptom of something very, very deeply wrong that's going on in the United States and throughout the Western world.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, indeed. I think as well, this is a good idea to keep in mind. We just briefly talked about that before we began, Mark, and it has to do with how people today, who at least then from an alternative point of view, can kind of understand a little bit more about what the Western media is doing, what the governments are doing in relation to, well, let's say how they treat Russia in the press or countries like Iran or Syria, etc.
Right.
I mean, as we know, the first casualty of any conflict is the truth in that regard. People, you know, when you have two sides that are going to, you know, belligerents going to go at each other, they do whatever it means they can to demonize the other side, to justify their actions of what they're going to do. But so to a certain extent, people can understand that in the context today. But many seem to have really, really difficulty applying this to the historical context. If we look at World War One, World War Two, or any of these conflicts that kind of falls outside of our modern media climate, if you will, why is that? Do you think?
That's very well put. Yes, this is a very good point. I try very hard to draw parallels between the distortion, the finger pointing, the demonization that goes on in our time. With the pattern of this behavior in the past as well. But people are very uncomfortable with that. And one of the reasons I think people are uncomfortable, because if they grasp or accept that this is part of a larger pattern, the implication, obviously, of that is that something is very, very wrong and has been for an awful long time, and that therefore the solution is not going to be some easy fix to the thing. That is, replacing George Bush with Barack Obama is not going to be enough to change to really change things in any fundamental way. Now, increasingly people see that, but that means then if the problem is really as entrenched as I think it is, and I think that history shows, it means that it's going to be a much more difficult task to turn things around than many people I think want to acknowledge. And also it means that many of the sort of comfortable ideas we have about our good or bad place in the world in the past, our good place in the world, are also just as empty as the pretenses that we've seen in more recent times.
So Germany, Japan, and Italy were at least halfway through the war during World War II.
This is particularly a feature of modern democratic societies, because the more a society is democratic, that is, the more it has to mobilize the mass of people for any kind of policy or war, the more it has to simplify and demonize the message in order to get the mass of people involved in it. This has been pointed out by many scholars of history and of public relations and so forth. In the past, in the 18th or 17th century, wars were really fought essentially by governments without mass participation. It was only in the modern era, after the French Revolution, that masses of people were drafted into wars, for example.
Right. Yeah.
Especially with the modern, with the 20th century, the advent of total war means mobilizing people in industry and civilian life for the big war effort. But that means then they've got to be persuaded to join this. And the only way to convince a mass of people in a modern democratic society is by presenting a message in a very simple way. The enemy is evil, he's going to destroy us, and he must be destroyed. And that's an extremely dangerous thing. It means that compromise is almost impossible. It not only demonizes, but terribly simplifies conflicts so that peaceful resolution becomes more and more difficult. But that's one of the features. Look, this goes back for quite a ways. The Spanish-American War, which was a landmark event in American history because it was its transition, you might say, from a republic to a kind of imperial state, saw the same demonization of Spain, of all countries.
Yeah.
During that conflict, the Americans were told, "Oh, the Spanish are just evil. They're just so backward and awful. We have to go to war against them." And we saw this reach a new height during the First World War, in which the Germans were portrayed as animal-like and Huns and so forth. And then, of course, the Second World War, we saw this. And now we see this, of course, with a similar kind of thing with Iran, with Bashar al-Assad in Syria and so forth. Whereas the reality is that wars are conflicts between interests and nations, and they have to be dealt with as prudently, as widely as possible, and not in a Manichaean good versus bad struggle in which the only choice then is to, as it were, destroy the bad people.
Yeah, it's a simplification. I think it's done also for the reasons of you want to try to lessen the impact of those who are to do the killing, which is what this boils down to ultimately. And it's a really good point that the reason why they need public support is to justify the actions of the state, whatever they're supposed to do. So what do you think we should get sources from in terms of World War One, World War Two, and to get a more balanced view on this whole, you know, scenario?
Well, of course, I think that a lot of very useful information and perspective is available on our website, IHR.org. But, you know, part of the problem is not just merely that information is accessible or people can find it. It really requires a certain temperament. The percentage of people in any society who have the heart or the soul or the interest in these kinds of questions and the, you might say, the intelligence or the wherewithal to really look at it in any detail is always a limited one. It's And so what we're trying to do, and I think what you're trying to do, inevitably can only reach only a small minority of people who even care seriously about these issues. Now, I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. I don't think a healthy society is one in which a large percentage of people are constantly psyched up about world affairs or so forth. A healthy society requires people just carrying out their lives in a decent, constructive, good way for themselves, their families, and so forth. But information is available, and I like to think that we're doing an important role in helping to educate people like that. But our main goal is to not reach the mass of people. We can't do that anyway. We don't have the facilities and so forth. It's really to reach, above all, the small minority of people who I hope and trust and pray will become leaders in the future, if and when and hopefully will have a more enlightened and a better leadership, both in political life and in cultural life and educational life in the future. If we're going to have even a future as a society or even as a world.
Well, you do a great job at IHR.org. You question, you reevaluate what we've been told, you know, reviewing of history. But it's also just what you said there, to get the ball, you know, rolling, basically, and to get more people thinking about this. And that has that snowball effect. And I think that that's really where the success might be, where more and more people. I mean, I think today, I got to say, though, when you see news articles online and whatnot, it's like, oh, God, you know, say more propaganda, whatever. But then you scroll down and look at the comments section, and you're like, wow, you know, not always, but in many cases, like, people are, they are kind of suspicious of everything by default. They're kind of, I mean, you can say what you want about that, but to a certain degree, there's a healthy skepticism there today, and they're
that's true.
You know, it's, I liked seeing that and reading that, actually.
Right, yes. Well, it's a thin line between a healthy skepticism on the one hand and a kind of despairing cynicism on the other.
Sure, sure.
But no, you're right. It is remarkable, over and over and over again. You've seen it, many people have seen it, how when a president of the United States or some official makes a pronouncement that's rather stupid, actually, people in the comment section show how widely people understand that what he's saying is nonsense, it's hypocritical, silly, really. That's a very, basically a healthy thing. But I know that for many people, even in my own family, they respond to all this with a kind of despair. They just think, oh, my God, it's pretty hopeless. And I don't want to see skepticism become just despair or cynicism either.
No, you're right. But, you know, as long as you question that, that's a really good start at least. And then we, you know, go from there. But if
yes.
We, yeah, go ahead if you want to comment on that.
No, that's, I agree completely. And but you see this all across now, the United States and the Western world. Unfortunately, though, that we don't see the rise yet, anyway, of an alternative leadership to offer a really viable alternative to, I think, where we're going. Where we should be going, I should say. Where we should be going. Right now, there's a great deal of anxiety about what's happening, skepticism, and so forth. But it yet hasn't given rise to political or cultural leadership or so forth that is able to put this in a comprehensive alternative to what we have right now.
Well, it's a good point, you know, basically where this is going. It could be a great promise in it, or it could be a great danger in it as well, because at the same time, I also see that there's a deep divide in society, an intense polarization of the political spectrum as it exists, and now that has hardened into different groups, of course, but it's just an intense, you know, battle out there, really. And it dawned on me the other day, Mark, that these are things that never will, they will not go away, if you know what I mean.
Yes.
I think there's nothing you will be able to solve in the regards of what words you throw at the other side now. These are so hardened and strengthened and firm in place that my question is like, all right, how do we proceed now without this again turning into what we saw, for example, in Germany before, you know, the rise of the National Socialists, because there was a tremendous battle in the streets between the communists and the other side as well, to this, the left wing and the right wing. And it's also out of that particular tremendous tension as well that you get a kind of a spasmic reaction in a different way, if you know what I mean. So this is something that can lead either way. You know, it can be something good or it can be something tremendously bad, right?
Yes, I agree. I think right now we're seeing in Europe and America a kind of groping towards some sort of new way of dealing with these problems, and it yet hasn't solidified. Right now it's just a kind of almost despair and anxiety, but yes, that's very true. You know, it took, though, the shattering of the old order in Europe at the end of the First World War for people to try to come to some idea of what to do out of the chaos of that. So you said the Bolsheviks or communists were offering one solution, and the National Socialists or fascists, and different people had different ideas, but that was only that arose only because of the collapse of the old order with the First World War. And we're seeing something like that now. Again, history offers a lot of lessons. They're never exact, though. They're never precise, just like with human beings. There's patterns of human behavior, but they're never exactly alike on the individual level and also on the social historical level. But I think we are in an age where there's a great deal of distrust, and there's a kind of groping for something. I find, though, overwhelming, when I talk to just ordinary people who don't know what I am or who I am or what, there's a large, I find, an amazing amount of consensus that not only that the path we're on is not a healthy or good one, but a kind of sense that, I think a common sense idea that we need a world that just takes it easier, doesn't hype up things, isn't on a path to spread democracy or freedom or equality or whatever it is all over the world, that we should do much more to get our own house in order rather than try to crusade around the world. All that, there's a widespread sense of all that about on that point, I think, and that's a healthy thing, I think.
Well, indeed. How do you view the crusades of our times, then, at least in the Western world, of all the things that we're trying to not only impose on other countries, of course, but also upon ourselves, and these, it feels to me that we're being led down a path which basically is largely, of course, untested. It's we really don't know what the consequences of the choices that we're making, what that really is going to become. And we can see again an increasing tension if we look at the climate in Europe, for example, and the different fractions of the political spectrum, and then just these tremendous battles in some cases on the streets, even for you to just be there and voice your, you know, opinion for a politically elected party or whatever. And it's just like, I don't know, it's something dodgy is going on there, you know.
Well, one expression of this, well, both the uncertainty among large numbers of people and the lack of the cluelessness of the system in dealing with it, is the Dieudonné affair in France.
Yeah,
Dieudonné has sort of stirred things up, and the system doesn't know quite what to do with him, really. It can ban him, but he continues to get more popularity, largely because his approach is, in many ways, a kind of comical one, a kind of wink and nod one, and the system doesn't know how to deal with that. It calls him names, it's, I think, a good expression of just how confused the system is in dealing with these kinds of challenges. The Dieudonné phenomenon, I think, is just one more expression of the large rejection of the Kant, the hypocrisy, the self-serving sloganeering of the system. He doesn't offer any real alternative exactly, and that's inevitable because he's essentially a comedian and entertainer. But it's part of the phenomenon that's taking place across the Western world that shows the kind of bankruptcy, I think, of the existing order and the existing system.
Can you tell me a little bit more about the French comedian? And I remember just briefly kind of running across this. And I know in some countries, as you said, there's been a huge kind of ruckus around this. But what happened there, really? Can you break that down for us a little bit?
Well, Dieudonné is a remarkable man. I actually met him briefly. He's half French, half Cameroon. He was once quite a leftist. Now he's supposedly a rightist, although those labels are really rather silly, I think.
In these times, they are, yeah.
Yeah, and he's really against the establishment. Now, they don't. The establishment doesn't get as angry when he's just against the establishment in a general way, but he's very critical of the hypocrisy over Israel, the oppression that's taking place, and so now he's called anti-Semitic and so forth. And he's come up with this kind of gesture called the canal, which his enemies say is a reverse Nazi salute. Well, I think that's just silly. It's a kind of a up yours gesture against the establishment. That's part of the problem for the existing order, because in France and increasingly around the world, the organized Jewish community is, I think, correctly identified as a pillar of the establishment. It's a major, it's protected the establishment in a way that no other group enjoys, that has that kind of protection. So anyway, this canal has become very popular. His videos are very popular. He's this very entertaining comedian, and he gets support from people across the political spectrum, left, right, center, who are largely just amused by the funny way that he sticks it to the establishment. And especially, though, the Jewish groups are just furious because a large part of his criticism of the establishment includes the Jewish establishment.
Right.
Well, that's part of the contradiction. You're supposed to, at the same time, not even acknowledge that the organized Jewish community has power. But if you challenge that power, you're going to be destroyed. It's a remarkable kind of paradox or doublethink, I suppose.
Yeah.
But the phenomenon is a remarkable one because of the large amount of support he's been able to garner on a kind of popular level, and the system is clueless about how to really deal with him.
Yeah, it's very curious how we're just not allowed to examine certain things and talk about them. And it doesn't mean that there's a preconceived conclusion in that questioning or line of questioning. It's just the very idea of talking about it. You have to speak below your breath. There's certain things, you know, certain sacred cows you're not allowed to talk about, you know.
Right. Very, very true. Yeah. I mean, for example, the Anti-Defamation League is arguably one of the most influential, powerful Jewish Zionist organizations in the world. And the head of the Anti-Defamation, Abraham Foxman, has come out with a book recently, which I discuss and so forth on our website, entitled Never Again. And he says one of the signs of anti-Semitism in a society is if people say yes to the question, do you think Jews have too much power? Just merely saying, agreeing that Jews have too much power is considered anti-Semitic.
Yeah.
Well, apparently, the answer is that Jews can never have too much power. No matter how great the power is, it's never too much, apparently. Well, that's just crazy. I mean, it's just insane. And yet, if somebody like Joe Biden or even Jewish organizations will openly acknowledge or even boast about the tremendous power and influence they have, that's sort of considered okay if they do it. But if the average citizen says, well, I think Jews have too much power, that's considered absolutely sinful and wrong. Now, you can say it about any other group. If you say, oh, I think corporations have too much power, or the Catholic Church or any other group has too much power, well, that's part of the general discourse. But in this case, if you say this group has too much power, why, then you're denounced as a hater and so forth in a way that is an obvious double standard in an open society or any kind of realistic society.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I've seen this too in other contexts. I remember I brought this up a couple of times, but it's just such a good one. It's Joel Stein out of the LA Times who wrote this article of who runs Hollywood, you know, and he voiced, obviously, in a boasting manner how proud he was that there were so many Jewish people in charge of the major studios. And it turned out into a really comedic piece, really, because he actually talked with Abe Foxman out of ADL as well. And he charged Joel Stein, who also is Jewish, with being an anti-Semite because he's reinforcing an old stereotype. But it's like, but it's true. What's the big deal?
This is a real, I mean, young people especially, who are generally much more indignant about when they're being lied to or deceived, this is so obvious. This double standard is so patent, so palpable, so obvious that naturally people are going to be very cynical, especially younger people, about that in any society. That's an obvious thing. And it's part also, I think, of a kind of real problem among youth, I think, in Western society. There's a real, compared to how I was when I was in my 20s or late teens, and even earlier people, there's a fracturing and an atomization of society that's really obvious to especially older people who have seen how normal bonds of social cohesion and trust have broken down tremendously in the society we live in. We live in a very consumerist, materialistic society, one of the consequences of which is a kind of, as I say, atomization, a fracturization, which is not only unhealthy, it's really contrary to our nature, I think, as human beings who crave and require social cohesion to operate as healthy human beings, I think.
Well, it's interesting because, I mean, you're really not allowed to even mention statistics anymore if it points in the wrong direction in terms of political correctness. You're not really allowed to talk about reality and the observations that you make as a human being in your own life. And this is, of course, I think this is a purpose as well, because that kind of creates a schizophrenic relationship between things that you do observe in your real life and then things that you're told that you can't say or talk about or anything like that. And it's interesting, but I think that's a really damaging aspect, actually, which shatters the psyche of some people if it goes far enough, if you know what I mean.
Yes, yes. And as I said, for many people, they just throw up their hands with all this and just have a kind of despair. They don't know who to believe. They don't know what to believe. They don't have the time or the wit, whatever, to try to figure it all out for themselves. And it's very unhealthy, very dangerous, really, for any kind of nation, society, country, whatever. No, that's very, very true. I mean, there's so many examples of this. A group, American politicians, for example, and groups like the Anti-Defamation League, they say over and over to Americans and to Swedes and Germans and Irish and so forth, diversity is a strength. Society should be as diverse as possible. As people should be just individuals. Social, racial, cultural cohesion is not good. We want as maximum diversity. And yet, these same organizations insist that Israel should be defended and preserved as a specifically Jewish ethno-religious society.
Yeah.
The same mantra, the same slogan, which is good supposedly for everybody else, exactly the opposite is supposedly good for Israel. Well, this is so blatant, so obvious, increasingly obvious, that people rightly, understandably conclude that the people who promote such slogans are either lying or deceitful or utterly ignorant about how the world is.
Well, exactly. And again, I can just talk about this from the context of Sweden, my own country, and we talked with Kevin McDonald about this too, but just the way that how even native the Swedes are treated these days, their own culture is frowned upon, even the Swedish flag is associated with racism. It's a diversity as long as it doesn't include a thing that has always been there, you know, as a constant in the past, if you will, to a certain degree. It's as long as it's something that has to do with that aspect of it, we don't want it. We want to throw it out, right?
Yeah. Well, this is it doesn't take a genius or an expert in sociology to see that this is really dangerous and foolish and stupid. And people see this, and you see this reflected in the despair, even public opinion polls in England and Europe, and even in America. But this is just one, this is another sign, another expression of the kind of, you might say, intellectual bankruptcy of the order of the times in which we live. We're seeing that, I think, the coming to an end of what can be called the post-war era, the era that emerged after the end of the Second World War. And to go to something now that's in the headlines, we're seeing Russia very forthrightly, boldly, overtly saying they are taking Crimea into Russia because the people there are Russian. In other words, they're making policy on the basis of ethnic realities and sentiments that are very deep and very strong.
Yeah.
And that's a challenge for countries like the United States, which insist that those shouldn't even be considerations. Well, they are for most people around the world, most nations around the world, and to pretend that ethnicity and culture and heritage are not important is to deny something very essential, very basic to human beings in history and in the real world.
Indeed. What is the? I want to talk more about Russia, by the way, in the second segment here in a little bit. But what is the workaround to some of these issues, do you think? Basically, what I'm thinking about is how to free ourselves from these particular constraints of how to get out of this the rut of both political correctness, of course, but also just this idea of you can't touch, you know, this or that, or this is sensitive, and everything is, you know, it's turning into this climate of it's eventually you can't do anything. You can't use a symbol, you can't, you know, use a specific color. Everything's going to be associated with something that someone is offended by. We're going to paint ourselves into a corner, and we're going to sit there with the, you know, white pajamas and not speak anything. I mean, where's this going? You know what I mean?
Right. Well, reality has a way of asserting itself, even if people don't want to acknowledge it. But I don't know how specifically where you're sort of going with the question, because it's a kind of an abstract one. But in Russia specifically, and around the world, a big motivator of people is their sense of belonging to a nation, an ethnicity, a religion, and so forth. And that's clashing with the ideology that prevails in the United States and Western Europe that says that none of those factors should be important, that they're meaningless, essentially. They're only superficial. Well, that's not how history works. It's not how the real world works. And we're seeing a clash between that. I mean, one of the more specific things about Russia is that the borders that emerged in the breakup of the old Soviet Union were borders and boundaries that were drawn up by the Soviet government, not by the people, and often do not reflect the ethnic, cultural realities in these areas. And a good example is Crimea. This is an area that had been Russian. It's overwhelmingly ethnically Russian. It was only part of Ukraine because Khrushchev made it that way in 1954 at the stroke of a pen. But the insistence upon trying to uphold a legalistic boundary that was made in the Soviet era is really a stupid one on the behalf of the by the United States or by anybody else, because the reality is that the ethnic feelings of people in Crimea and Russia and elsewhere are very important, and they can't be ultimately suppressed or denied.
Well, exactly. This is we have the much praised ideology currently in the West. Many people, anyway, that it's experimental globalism. Really, the concept we're all one. We're all, you know, we're all the same kind of idea, and it clashes obviously with some of the things that Russia and some of the other countries have been doing here. Let's return to that a little bit later too, and ask you a little bit more about Ukraine and everything else. But let's take a short break here, Mark. And before we do that, let's give out all the websites. Let's talk about if there's any book titles you'd like to recommend or anything of your latest stuff that people can catch up with and follow you more regularly.
Well, I urge people, of course, to check out our website, www.ihr.org, IHR.org, Institute for Historical Review. I urge especially to take a look at the items on the homepage. The search feature will find much, much more on a very, very wide range of issues. But the homepage alone has a lot of more recent or topical items that I think many listeners will find really interesting and enlightening. A lot of it isn't really unique. I mean, some of the perspectives are ones you'll find on other places. But I think we try to put it in a historical context that you will not find in many other organizations or sites doing.
Absolutely, very good. IHR.org. Follow along in the news there and get a different perspective as well from that. All right, we'll take a short break here, Mark. We'll return with more shortly.
Rose of passes, I'll burn down on me, yeah.
In the second hour, we speak more directly about World War II history, the demonization of Germany, the firebombing of Dresden, Eisenhower's German death camps, the rape of German women after the war, and the German hate of Winston Churchill. We talk about Germany today and their role in the European Union. Later, we discuss violations of privacy rights, like what the NSA and Echelon over in the UK is doing, and why the government are doing nothing about this. They are demonizing people like Snowden and Assange, while on the contradictory flip side, promoting behavioral rights like gay rights and uplifting LGBT rights champions as the greatest heroes of our time. A very interesting paradox, an oxymoron that really shows the nature of our governments. To listen to the second hour with Mark Weber, sign up at redicemembers.com if you're not already a member, that is. This, of course, helps us to grow and keep moving with more people assisting us, the more we can produce and head in the right direction that we want with regular video reports beyond the three radio shows that we do per week right now. Next step from here is, of course, live TV broadcasts and extensive coverage of all the madness. So if you like what we do, help us out. Support our projects, redeyesmembers.com. It's only the price of about 2 cups of coffee per month. Judith Mary Baker, Patrick Henningsen, Stephen McNallan, and many more are coming up. We'll be taking a Monday next week off due to attendance at the Electric Universe Conference in Albuquerque, but we'll be back on Wednesday again with vengeance. Thank you for listening, and thank you for your membership. We'll speak to you on the other side.